Happy Shabbat to everyone, and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We're here with Kirk and the Larianator. How are you, fellas?
Good.
Great, thank you.
Oh, good. I wanted to begin just kind of on an off-the-wall topic that I received some criticism on the other day, and the criticism was valid, so I have no issue with the person who indirectly criticized me by conveying this to another individual who later conveyed it to me. I happen to agree that what I said was insufficient. What I said was that the Chawa was presented to Adam as an alternative to Yahweh. That Yahweh did not want us to choose him by default because man in solitary, man deprived of socialization, goes insane. And so God didn't want Adam to choose him based upon the alternative being going insane with loneliness. And so in the same discussion of the tree of discernment of the knowledge of good and evil and having the opportunity of choosing to spend time with God, God created for Adam a perfect, ideal companion that was an alternative. And if you just stop there, you know, first of all, that is profound. I mean, I'm going to tell you, Kirk, because you were saying earlier today that if, you love your wife, the last thing you're going to do is to create for your wife a really handsome, young, virile alternative to move across the street.
Exactly.
All right. But Yahweh did.
I know.
Something really, really attractive as an alternative. Now, that is an incomplete statement. Yahweh was not calling, you know, like Satan as the alternative, the real alternative to not Yahweh. He's not associating woman with Satan or anything in the least. What he did is he created a scenario whereby you could choose both. And that the ideal scenario was both, that you could fall in love with this woman and marry this woman and engage in a covenant marriage vow with this woman and experience what it's like to raise children and to be a parent like Yahweh is and really understand Yahweh's role with us, with this woman, and to do with this woman what, Kirk, you have the chance to do with Terry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're married to a woman who knows Yahweh, who's part of the covenant, and
right.
It's just got to make your relationship with Terry much richer, much better.
Of course.
And that was the opportunity that was given to Adam. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just to have this relationship with this this marvelous creation, this beautiful woman, but also to incorporate her into the relationship. So
and
when I said
perspective on Yahweh, sure.
Yeah, that when Yahweh, that Chawa was an alternative to Yahweh, and that was incredibly generous on his part and wise on his part, so we wouldn't choose him by default. That's a true statement, but there's more to it than that. And so what I wanted to add is that his, and just everything he does is so perfect. What he did is he created a scenario where Adam and Chawa could together enjoy their experience with Yahweh in such a way that reflects and mirrors the covenant so they would have a perspective on what Yahweh was trying to accomplish and be able to experience it firsthand, what it's like to be married and to raise a family and to share together. And so that's a more complete explanation. And for whoever it was, I don't know the woman's name. I apologize for giving incomplete information, but I was so excited just to realize that the creation of Chawa was directly related to choice and was spoken in the same breath as the tree of the discernment between good and evil. And just like that tree, the tree is not necessarily bad.
No.
A tree, I mean, knowledge is a really wonderful thing. You can, discernment's a really good thing. Mm-hmm. It's what you do with it, you know. Woman, from a man's point of view, is a really wonderful thing. It's what you do with her that matters. You know, so it's...
I like that woman. I saw a religious individual on a social website go by, and he had written, it was originally Woe Man, W-O-E-M-A.
Yeah, I know.
I said, are you kidding? I said, first of all, I showed him in Paleo-Hebrew how it was written. I said, secondly, the word woe is hoy.
You idiot.
I mean, they really push this kind of crap. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Of course, the only difference between man and woman, Ish is the Hebrew word for man, Ish is the Hebrew word for woman.
Ish versus Ish.
Right. There's no woe.
Yeah, I know. There's no woe to it. Woe is holy. You know, it's not holy.
Yeah, of course. And what's the most marvelous thing, of course, of all, is that Yahweh is a feminine name.
Mm-hmm.
Feminine name. Ends in the hay. And any word that ends in the hay, I mean, that's how you, you know, son is Ben. Bena is daughter. I mean, all you do is any word that ends in the hay is feminine. Yahweh is a name, and it's written in such a way. Now, I understand that Yahweh's primary manifestation to us is our Heavenly Father. But in our world, he interacts with us as the set-apart spirit, which is our spiritual mother. And his name is based upon the characters of the covenant. And I mean characters in a very positive way, Abraham and Sarah. And so, you know, the first person reaching up is Abraham. The last one is Sarah. And so, Yahweh has a feminine name. And I love that about you. There's just nothing pretentious about Yahweh.
You know, speaking of brilliant, I'm going to go over a couple brilliance real quick, if it's okay.
Right.
One, we've been covering a lot of ground on Sheol, because Yahweh covers a lot of ground on Sheol.
Yeah.
And, killing billions of people, if you could expose Adolf Hitler before he, came to power, you might want to try to do that.
But Adolf Hitler was a piker. Adolf Hitler indirectly led to the
totally
million
piker.
People.
Yeah, I understand.
You're dealing with Paul. You're talking about 5 billion, not 50 million.
Yeah, no, I understand that, too. Even he probably has killed more than 50 million just in wars. You know, just in religious wars.
Yeah, I didn't say a word about it. Not even a piece.
Yeah, well, I'm just bringing this up for a reason, though. I mean, Sheol and Sheol. And today, if you're Jewish, you run off to the synagogue or the shul. The shul.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is brilliant, isn't it? It's like naming your kid Sheol. Just an insane possibility to me. I look at it.
Why would you name your kid after the place of separation from God?
Or
why would you name your kid after the ultimate failure with God?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Yahweh says that the person that is the plague of death is named Shaul. There aren't a lot of them around.
Yeah, but then again, you get a shul. A shul. S-H-U-L. You know, and same root. It really is.
Right. And they have a prayer shul.
Yeah, I know. And, I was talking, and of course, Yahweh doesn't have a temple. I mean, if temple.
No, you know what's really interesting
to me
is I'm
religious
right
activities.
Now spending all my time in Chronicles. I mean, I never thought. I mean, here I've written now 4 chapters on Shamuel. We've already covered the 2 on Shamuel, and I've written 2 on Yahshiyah. We haven't covered yet on this part of the program, but now I'm into a chapter on Chronicles. I never thought I'd be translating Chronicles. But as I translate Chronicles, what I'm finding is that the subject matter and the insights are every bit as profound. They're all consistent. And it's, God's on the same path, which is, my God, don't be religious.
He just turns into it.
By all means, don't be sitting around praying to me. God, I want people who are willing to engage, who are man's man. Your ears may have been burning earlier, but I just finished translating a passage where Dod says that Solomon, his son, is ready to be king. And he says, the reason he's not ready to be king is he's way too nice. He's way too tender, way too soft, way too easygoing. He says, to be king, you got to be tough. You got to be a man's man. You got to be hard. You got to be willing to engage and to stand up and to bow your back. And my son's none of those things. Not at this point. What God said is, I want a man to be a man. I want a woman to be a woman. I want to engage with people who are willing to devote their back and take a stand, who are tough-minded, who are aggressive. You know, it's that's what he likes.
The other kind of brilliance I just wanted to talk about real quick, and I was talking with Jackie last night. We just kind of got into the whole dimensional thing. You know, it you often talk about the lack of creativity of HaSatan, you know, and of Halal, and it's true. He it's always the same counterfeit with a twist. You know,
right.
over
sure.
and over
right.
and over and over.
Right.
You know, yet you know when you think about the creativity of Yahweh to create a dimension based on time, which is something he doesn't live in.
Right.
His dimension
right.
is never time because his name is I exist. That means there's no beginning or end. Time is just made up for us. Call it a blessing. Call it a burden. Call it whatever you want. But
right.
It's just in
right.
this dimension. And I'm not saying there couldn't be time in another dimension. Maybe there is. There's a number of them. But in this dimension, you know, that's what we're tied to.
We're stuck in.
In reality, it doesn't exist. But to create a dimension and then say, I'm going to diminish a part of myself and go interact with the creation
right.
within this dimension is brilliant. I mean, not that any of us should be blown away by the brilliance of Yahweh, but I mean,
when,
if you start looking at it from that perspective, it's huge.
When
I mean,
Joe's talking about the house, and by the way, you said it's not a temple, it's a house. Throughout the presentation and Chronicles, that's the point I was going to make, it is constantly referred to as a bayah, not a temple, a house for the family. And it is one of the places Dode is listing all the stuff that he's providing. And Dode's feeling really sheepish. He's really feeling guilty. I mean, he let Yahweh down. And he's feeling really sheepish. And so he's listing all the stuff that he's providing for this. And then he goes into what he's being given in return. And one of the things, he's got three things on the list that he's being given. One of the three is, I made increase in dimensions. My dimensionality is being increased. Just lays it right there. Says I'm delighted that I'm being yearned for. God really wants my company, and that I'm going to be part of His family. And he says I'm going to be literally a golden brilliance in terms of my nature. But I'm most excited about the fact that I'm going to be increased in dimensions. Right there.
I mean, that's strong. That's a statement. It's not like people understood there were dimensions back then. There is, again, you know, prophecy raises its ugly head, you know, to say, look, you know, I mean, that's one of those things as subtle, you know, as the female ants, you know, that you can just blow by if you don't stop and think about them. You know, that's... you know, I don't know anyone else talking about dimensions. I don't see anybody else talking about light. I don't see anybody else tying their name to light and to a different dimension. I mean, Yahweh's name, it means he comes from a different dimension. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Yeah, I think it was Roy, though, that explained, and it was just so profound to me when he explained it. There's two things that he did that were really, really important to me. One is that, you know, when Walt Disney created the two-dimensional realm of Mickey Mouse, it was extraordinarily easy. It takes almost nothing out of the three-dimensional being to create a two-dimensional realm. Now, Walt was not capable of creating life, but he did create a two-dimensional realm, flatland, for Mickey and Minnie Mouse. And the only way that he could interact with them was via implements. A pen and paintbrush. And that was the only way that he could interact with his creation. And Yahweh has implements too. That's why he constantly says that I am Yahweh of the Shabbat, of the spiritual implements, because it's the spiritual implements that he can send into our dimensional constructs, since he himself cannot enter it, just like Walt can't enter the world of Flatland where Mickey and Minnie are. But Walt can interact with them using implements. Yahweh is of the Saba, and the spiritual implements that he uses to interact with us. I thought that was profound, but I also thought it was profound to know that a seven-dimensional entity can create a six-dimensional universe without any effort. extraordinarily easy for them to do. So now to create one that is that's filled with life and that has all of the ramifications of what we have is you know, mind-bogglingly complex. But it was not difficult. It did not. You know, I always wonder, how could God create all of the 100 billion stars and 100 billion galaxies and not deplete his own energy? Well, as a seven-dimensional construct, creating a six-dimensional entity, it wasn't even a rounding error. It was insignificant what he had to create, used to create this massive universe.
Just sort of like what Kirk does when he makes a picture.
Yeah, it's not the hardest job in the world.
I'm just saying it's insignificant.
It takes nothing from you other than some of your time and some of your focus to create a two-dimensional realm in your picture.
Right.
It took nothing from you other than some time and some focus and some thought to create a six-dimensional universe, no matter how big it is. Those are very profound kinds of thoughts. And you know, when you understand dimensions, you understand how being showing Abraham, when Abraham says, "I don't get what I'm inheriting," and taking Abraham to the light of the stars to show him, this is what I'm giving you. You're going to be transformed into light. And what that means in terms of eternity and time and capability to travel and to explore and to be eternal. You know, it's a very profound thought, and I agree. There are very few people that are talking about it. Now,
we haven't read anything new in the Torah for years, and it's been sitting there. We've become pretty smart people, and we're about the only people talking about it. Isn't that amazing? Doesn't that amaze you sometimes?
Yes. Yes.
All the scientists in the world don't relate any of that to that?
Right. For 3,400 years, it's been there. And yet, very few people are talking about it. And that's the power of prophecy. Just to bring people up to speed that have not listened to the observations program earlier today, Kirk received a very nice letter, so understanding we're not being critical.
No.
It is one of my concerns, and so I'm speaking here from an empathetic position. Well, somebody wrote, Kirk, says we're spending too much time on Paul. We need to get back to the benefits of the covenant. And we spent the entire hour talking about why we're so focused on Paul and why that is going to change a little bit, but not totally. And the primary, you know, I listed six reasons during the show, and I want to go over all six. But I do want to emphasize this one. And that is that we, collectively, have all eternity to get to know Yahweh, to explore with him, to enjoy his company, to learn directly from him. And, you know, as a conduit of who God is and what he's offering, compared to getting it directly from Yahweh, you know, I can tell you that, and I can speak for you fellas as well, we're pretty anemic compared to what it's going to be. And so since we have all eternity and we're going to get it straight from Yahweh, while it is fun to do that and enjoyable and nurturing for us to do that, we don't have a lot of time. We only have 10 years of where we're going to be able to awaken a lost generation where we can let people know that the things that they're trusting are unreliable, that God is opposed to them, and that if they were to leave them, that God has proven his existence and has delineated a path where we can enjoy his company for all eternity. We only have 10 years to share that. And the people that are listening to that, have 17 years to respond to it. Anywhere from one day to 17 years at the absolute maximum. So what's the best use of our time?
Okay, we're doing.
We're unlimited in one aspect, and we're limited in the other.
We've got to cover what we're limited in, and we have to expose the nonsense. I mean, all this religion comes out of the same pile of, the same cesspool. Mm-hmm. It's a cesspool. Uh-huh. It's just the worst of the worst of the worst.
Right.
True.
And the counterfeits as I say, they're always the same. I mean, you were talking about the Dionysus sun cult. You could go to the Druids for the earth pig, Hesus, and all the rest. And by the way, he was a carpenter, I think. Hesus that became Jesus was a carpenter, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And it goes on and on like this. And until people understand that they've been had, that the idea of faith and belief is somehow going to save them, which is as laughable as it gets. I mean, if you think about it, all Yahweh's saying is, I want people with open minds who have responded to me. Isn't that what he's really saying?
We're not trying to save the religious.
No, they can't.
We're not trying to save those who are patriotic and political. We have no interest in it. We're not trying to. We don't care. God doesn't care about them. We don't care about them. But to the extent that there are people who are beginning to question those things, if they can, as they begin to question, Google answers for their questions and find a resource that is exposing in very clear terms why governments and militaries and religions are not to be trusted, and why God does not want us affiliated with them, and why God himself is opposed to them, and why this same God proves his existence and delineates the course of action that we need to follow if we want to spend eternally with him, and that he is the real deal. If they can find that voice, and there's 1,000 more people that become part of the covenant, because even if there's 100, and there have been hundreds who have become part of the covenant because of it, then we have used our resources and time to the absolute best possible way.
Yeah.
And what we're doing here is the antithesis of conservative American politics. You know, in conservative American politics, they want to build that huge wall on the Mexican border, and they want to deport all of the Hispanics. What we're saying in the covenant is, the more the better.
Open doors.
Open door, man. Open door. Well, to what extent? We don't want you if you're religious. We don't want you if you're political. We don't want you if you're militaristic. So long as you're willing to drop that garbage and cling only to and trust only Yahweh, we want you. The more you know,
we've got an open door policy. Yeah, we sure do.
No doubt about it.
The difference between Yahweh's words and religious teaching is stark. I mean, they are in complete opposition. One seems to be focused on belief, faith, and being a sexual prude. And forgiveness. That's the other thing. I did a note on that, by the way. I want to run this past.
I just love every time that that Christianity is fixated on being a sexual prude, on never fornicating. Of course, they are the worst in the world in terms of.
They're whores.
Look at Baylor University, the biggest Baptist university. They're complete and utter fraud.
But Yahweh doesn't even talk about. He talks about whoring in religion. I mean,
I love the fact is that Yahweh's favorite person, clearly his favorite son of all the humans that have ever lived, was a guy that was the prince of fornication.
Yeah, he was really all out.
He was all out. He figured that
and so was his son.
And that women are beautiful, and he and his son love the girls.
Absolutely. It's astounding. But I wanted to bring something up here real quick. When we talk about these corruptions, and so much of the religious nonsense out there in Christianity is based on what? Forgiveness, isn't it? I mean, it's forgiveness. One thing that Yahweh openly tells us is that the Torah is going to flow from the lips of the Messiah, of the Messiah. And it did. I mean, there can be no question that it did.
Matthew 3 and 5. Are devoted almost entirely, or 5 and 7, I'm sorry, 5 and 7 are divided almost entirely to the Torah.
I just want to read this passage before and after, and then make a comment. And this is in Malachi, where he says Yehuda has been unfaithful, has committed adultery, and has committed an abomination in Yisrael and in Yerushalayim. Because they have defiled and dishonored Yehuda and the sanctuary for those who are set apart, who relationally Yahweh loves, they are married to Lord Baal and wed and the house of a foreign pagan god. Yahweh will cut off the individual who does this, who witnesses or afflicts from the household of Yaakov when Yahweh's offering gift approaches and becomes present. Now, I want you to actually, you know, this is what I said. Now, put it up against this. Forgive them, for they know not what they do.
He didn't say that.
He didn't say that. I mean, you know, why do they have to put words in Yahusha's mouth, in Yahweh's mouth, that he didn't say? I mean,
it's like the two guys on the crosses next to him and said, you know, one of them says, you know, that you will be with me this day in paradise. Well, that day, from the Hebrew point of view, was about to end in about an hour.
And we went right into matzah where he was in jail.
Right. And the next day was matzah, and Yahusha most certainly wasn't going to be in paradise. There is a zero possibility he said that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a zero possibility he said this. I mean, it's just insanity on steroids.
Right.
And this is why we're doing what we're doing, because people need to look at the words God said and compare them with what's in their Christian...
Yeah. Even as early as Dabarim. The Dabarim was delivered, you know, at the same time that Barashith and Shemoth and Kara and Bamidbar were presented.
Mm-hmm.
Within a few months of that time, we have Dabarim. So we have the first four books of the Torah all delivered during that 40 days and 40 nights that Moshe is up there on Mount Horeb with Yahweh and Yahusha. And then Moshe comes down, because this is God. This is Yahweh's style. Yahweh's style is, I created the universe because I wanted to engage with man. There's something noble about work, and I wanted to work with man. And so Dabarim is Moshe, who has spent these 40 days listening to Yahweh, getting to know him personally, and having engaged with Yahweh, sharing with the children of Yisrael what the Torah teaches in such a way they could apply it to their lives. That's what Dabarim. And in Dabarim, twice, Moshe goes out of his way and says, listen, you're going to be wondering, and you should wonder, you should question everything, what is coming from Yahweh, and you should trust in what is not from Yahweh. And so God, right there in the first time he's communicating through man, he says, I want to tell you how you should go about making this decision. Now, do you think he would have said that if there wasn't going to be things that claimed to be from him that were not?
Mm-hmm. Of course not.
Good. For example,
right there in Dabarim, he says not to read Christian material. He describes
Solomon. And you look at Solomon. Yahweh loves Solomon. There's no question about it. And Yahweh loves Solomon not only because he was Dod's son. It's like I love my granddaughter, because my granddaughter is my son's daughter. And Yahweh, no doubt, loves Solomon because Solomon was Dod's son. But it's also because when Yahweh asked Solomon what he wanted, Solomon says, you know, didn't give the normal, I want, you know, to win every battle. I want lots of money. I want the prettiest women. Yeah, you know, I want the biggest kingdom. I want the greatest riches. He didn't give that answer. He says, I want wisdom. I want the ability to think. Yes, good choice. Very, very impressed with that. But unfortunately, Solomon spent his wisdom, his ability to think, analyzing his life and his personal experiences. Ecclesiastes is a intellectual overview of Solomon's own experiences. Dod didn't do that. I think Dod was equally as brilliant as Solomon, if not brighter than Solomon. But Dod did not discuss in any length his own personal experiences. You read his lyrics of his Psalms, they're about him studying and observing Yahweh's testimony, particularly his Torah, and then sharing with us the insights he gleaned from studying the Torah.
Yeah, instead of writing an autobiography or, you know,
right.
Exactly.
Right. And so he focused on different material. Now, the reason I share all this is that there are books that are written by Solomon, which I do not think are from God. I don't think they're inspired. I mean, I think it's interesting to read Ecclesiastes, but I don't think it's inspired. The Song of Solomon, you know, I think it's just Solomon's love for a woman. And there's a bunch of Proverbs. There's Proverbs that are clearly prophetic, 6 and 7. Clearly prophetic, clearly from Yahweh. 8, it's a mixed bag, and it gets back into human wisdom. I think it's from Solomon. I don't think it's inspired. And I think Yahweh gave us the means for us to make that determination. So, you know, if you have a means to know if it's from Yahweh or from not, you know, why not spend our time translating and contemplating the things that are obviously from Yahweh and just not bother with the things that are not?
No, I've always said I'd rather have a half a bowl of cereal that's pure than one that's half, that's full, that's half poison. I mean, what's the point?
Yeah.
So, there
exactly.
You go.
So, there's one of the things I was sharing, though, with Kirk earlier is that one of the reasons that we expose government politics behind the fact that Yahweh does. If the first condition of the covenant is so counterintuitive, it is so counter-societal, it is so unpopular, that if you don't explain why Yahweh has asked us to walk away from our country and to walk away from Babel, which is synonymous with the corruption of religion, if you don't take the time to explain why these things are counterproductive, then you're asking people to trust Yahweh based on faith, to take a leap of faith to walk away from religion.
You can't.
And I don't
think you have to show
God doesn't
have
to do that, so we ought to provide the same insights so that people understand why God is opposed to government, why he's opposed to...
Well, he's right down the line on all of it. I mean, he comes right out. I mean, think about all the people who have followed king and country. Now, I mean, like, think about this. And then, you know, you go right back to what's etched in stone. You know, and he tells you, you're not supposed to be talking to these objects and making pledges to them. And they've got, you know, I mean, America the Great, right? I mean, you're marching your kids out and they're making pledges. I did it. Early in the morning to the flag, aren't they? I mean, really. And these very same people are bitching that there's no prayer in school. Well, first of all, he doesn't...
I'm reading something here about
prayer.
Somebody that's... I don't know if I'm only jumping in the middle of it, that's having a difficult time wondering why. You made the point, Larry, that it's always the whore is always a woman. And that religion is depicted in feminine terms. I want to take a stab as to why that is the case, because clearly when you look at what Adam and Chawa did in the garden, there really is no distinction between the choice made by Adam and the choice made by Chawa. God holds them both accountable.
That's right. Yeah,
and
that's right.
God's condemnation of the people engaged in religion and politics, he's always condemning men for their promoting of religion and politics while referring to religion as a female. So the perpetrators are men. The entity he refers to is a female. So, like, when we're talking about the whore of religion, the whore is almost, the perpetrators are almost never women, although Chawa was a perpetrator, just as was Adam. The perpetrators are not usually women. The perpetrators are usually men. But the entity is feminine. And I think the entity is feminine, why the Yahweh refers to the whore of Babylon and of religion as being a whore, is because it's a counterfeit for the set-apart spirit.
Like holy, as an example.
Counterfeit.
Holy was the consort to Krishna. So, she was married.
Holy, the covenant is feminine. Torah is feminine. The set-apart spirit is feminine. And so the whore is the counterfeit to the feminine aspects of God's plan. And I think that's...
No, and I agree with that. I've even thought of that. But what I was pointing out there was you know, these people, they talk about everything is based on their sexual purity and all these things. You know, there's an exception of Wicca or a couple of little subgroups like that, but you know, all your major religions really push their lack of sex as some kind of a badge of honor, and meanwhile, they're all whoring all day long. It's really laughable.
Islam is constantly saying that the West deserves to be destroyed because of pornography and the sexual immorality and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. And meanwhile, on Google, they're the number one in pornography.
Right.
Bestiality. Anything but sex between two consenting adults, by the way.
They're number one in bestiality. They're number one in the sexual mutilation of little girls. They're number one in turning girls into sex slaves. They're number one in rape. And so, you know, here they claim sexual purity and they're the most perverted people on the planet. You know, you look at the things that are surrounding Baylor University right now, or the Roman Catholic Church, and sexual perversion has become their signature. You look at the televangelists; most of them are sexual perverts. And so,
they're following after Paul, aren't they? It isn't just his sexual proclivities were unnatural, but at the same time, you know, Yahweh said that was one of the reasons he developed his religion, because he liked looking at other men's genitals. I mean, come on.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing new about this.
Yeah, in Romans 7, Paul says that he is a sexual pervert. Now, he claims that the Torah made him a sexual pervert.
Made him so.
That was instruction to me. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, it's like saying that if somebody provided you with instructions on how to make lemonade, squeeze lemons, add a little bit of water, add some sugar, and those are the instructions to make lemonade, and you instead made a poison, and you blame the recipe for Kool-Aid or lemonade for making your poison, it's kind of like Paul blaming the Torah for him being a sexual pervert.
Well, it's too stupid for words. Truly.
I don't understand how there can be 2.4 billion Christians on the planet today, as stupid as the religion is.
Well, I think it's because even though they question, I don't even know that they openly question. I think that the vast majority just go, well, this is what the scholars have told us. I mean, I had it out with two scholars about a week ago. And so I did a note, and I misspelled scholars on purpose.
Yeah,
that was the title of it was, I'm impressed with your scholars. And, you know, all I did was showed what was in extant material up against what's in, a Biblia today. And I said, so I'm not really impressed with you scholars, not even a little. One was a preacher, and the other was his scholar buddy, and they immediately blocked me and got the hell out of there because they were scared to death. You know, they had been, you know, laid naked. If anybody was watching this conversation, they were just buried. I mean, that was it. And they knew it, too. But this is the same old piece. They rely on people being lazy about this and really not investigating any of it. You know, I went to notes, and I'm not knocking this. I mean, it's been very effective. I went to notes because I used to hand out the entire book of Yada Yah. Uh-huh. And I just didn't get any takers.
Right.
You know, you got to sit down and read 3,000 pages, buddy, or whatever. You know, I mean, this is going to take some effort on your part.
Right.
Along those lines, Larry, what I've done this week is I've been studying an old book that I've had on my library, the New Testament Documents Are They Reliable by F.F. Bruce, and I've got up to about page 20. I read it a long time ago, but I'm reading it now with new eyes, new set of eyes, and they're trying to prove, now this is every scholar around, I mean, the footnotes are huge, and they've tried to prove that because this document of Paul is accurate, and the next one is not that far off, and all these different centuries and so forth. But not one time on my little notes I wrote over here, not one time have they even done any comparison or brought out the fact that Yosha never said anything that Shaul said, or Shaul never said anything that Yosha said. I mean, they missed some of the most obvious things, but because...
Well, they're only at, they're reliable is... Has the
reliable, somebody's returning pretty close to what he said, but that doesn't mean about the reliability
over time, or is the text of the Pauline letters substantiated through the litany of extant documents? And I would tell you that if your basis for saying is the New Testament reliable, and if you're going to limit the New Testament to the part that is that Christianity is based, which would be the Pauline letters.
Yeah, you'd have to say it's pretty accurate. You'd have to
say it's fairly accurate. I think the difference is, you know, I made an attempt to examine the differences between P46, Papyrus 46, mm-hmm. which is the oldest witness to Paul's letters. It's dated late 1st century, early 2nd century. When you realize that Paul wrote his first letter 52 CE and Galatians and his last letter probably 10 to 15 years thereafter, late 1st century, early 2nd century means that Papyrus 46 is the earliest extant witness, yeah, probably that there is of anything that you would ever hope to find attributed even falsely to God. And the differences between the two are almost all limited to grammar. Almost all limited to grammar. You know, if you look at the differences, you know, we have one book in its entirety, the Book of Yeshayah. And if you look at the Book of Yeshayah and you compare it to the Masoretic text, they differ in 1 in 13 to 1 in 14 words. Most of the differences are fairly small. But there are, of those differences of 1 in 13 to 14 words, about 10% of that is grammar. You know, a different stem, a different conjugation of the verb, for example. So grammar represents about 10% of the variation. Of Papyrus 46 versus the basis of English translations of Paul's letters, about 90% of the variants were grammar. And understand that the Greek has some much more complicated grammar than we have in English in terms of tenses. And so that was the primary difference.
One thing I just want to add here, I mean, you're a bigger expert on this than I am, but there's also some very truncated stuff. As an example, when Paulos is out there going, you know, if a guy was crippled, I act like I was crippled. If a guy was into the Torah, I tricked him so I could gain off of it. I acted like I was a Torah observant. And then if a guy was non-Torah, then I acted like him. And, of course, that's been truncated, too. I've become all things to all people. You know? In other words, they don't blatantly show he said he was a liar, you know, which is what he said there.
Yeah, there's two different issues. One issue is, do we have a textual legacy that shows that what Paul actually wrote when he wrote it has been maintained forward over time? And if you're looking at Paul's letters, the answer to that is resoundingly yes. While there are, you know, while the Christian New Testament is horrendous in terms of its textual fidelity, it has, you know, there's 182,000 words approximately in Greek, and there's 300,000 variants. So the textual fidelity, the credibility of the Christian New Testament as a whole is right next to nil. But the exception is Paul's letters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul's letters are not credible in the sense that what he writes is irrational and contradictory. But there is a textual history that shows that they have been faithfully maintained, because there was no reason for the church to change anything that he said.
No.
Because what he said is the religion of Christianity. if they had to change virtually everything that Yosha said and did because he was so contrary to their religion.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, Yao Kanan doesn't even look the same. I mean, it's just totally butchered. I mean, it's just
it's completely butchered. It is completely butchered. The only book that I think that, I mean, I think that there are two texts that are quasi-reliable. I think that Matanya is
Revelation.
Probably 90% reliable. And I think Revelation is probably 80% reliable.
That was a book they didn't want to add to their canon. I don't think they understood it. So
that the book of Yao Kanan is probably 70% reliable, maybe 60. And that beyond that, you're just down in the sewer.
When you start changing 60 or 70%.
Was that, that the Christian New Testament is reliable because we have a textual
change is made, going back to the first century.
Right. There's been very little change in the text.
Never been changed, and we all agree that he's fine. Right. I mean, how absurd is that? And here's two other things they do. The Oxford Society of Historical Theology, 1905, they also make a point that this is not only great stuff, but the Catholic Church venerates this, as does the Gnostic School of Millennium. And the Catholic Church loves them.
The same Pope that demoted Jesus 2 years ago. I mean, he demoted him. He demoted Jesus.
So it comes to questioning Paul before anybody questions Paul.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, God knows.
How do you demote your God? Anybody know that? Anybody get that one? They demoted him. Mary's above him, then the church, the Pope, and then the baby Jesus. You know, wow. I nominate Bugs Bunny. I mean, that's it.
Oh, they also, let me throw one more thing into there. They also talk about the credibility of something is not, if you have to discern it by spiritual insight, not historical research.
Really?
Faith over fact.
Right.
Faith over fact.
You can't make this stuff up, guys.
Yeah, it says fact over faith.
Yeah, exactly. Prove me right or prove me wrong. Go ahead. Take your shot.
Well, you know, that's a good point. That's a very good point, what you just said there, because, you know, Lisa had shot over to me the actual breakdown of Baal, okay? And we know Baal means Lord. I mean, there's no, but the etymology of the word Baal, B-A-L.
B-A-L-A,
Bala. Is to cross over, to pass through, to overturn, to go around, to go upside down, to go against, to change, You know, and so, yeah, sure, that's Baal right there, isn't it? I mean, that's it, isn't it?
Anything but the right path.
Right, and Craig, you just said it's in total opposition. Yahweh says, you know, fact over fiction, and they say, well, you know,
faith over fact.
Well, technically, they say the Lord promises to guide you.
Using evidence that your religion is bupkis, as we do in Course of Questioning Paul, or as Yahweh does it in Chabaok, proves that your religion is bupkis, then what you do is you reject the historical accuracy of the testimony, and you believe the lie. But you're saying.
So let me ask you this: if you were trying to defend this case where they say, you know, it's the Spirit guides you, then you have to believe that this Holy Spirit they're talking about doesn't know the difference between what it in their terminology offered versus what now Paul offers. I mean,
you'd have to believe it, and I'd have to say this about this Holy Spirit, it's got to be an it. Probably
transgender. Can't be female or male, and it's always an it.
Probably transgendered, more than likely.
Well, in Greek, sonoma is a neuter.
Neutral.
Neutral gender noun. So it is an it, even though in the Greek they use all masculine pronouns to describe it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, but this transgendered it holy thing, what you're saying, Kirk, is that it doesn't even know understand historical perspectives either.
No, so it's all of a sudden, all of a sudden it tells these people this is the new way. It's okay.
It's just retarded.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
and by the way, spiritual discernment, guess who the most active spirit is in the world today? And has been for a long time.
That would be Baal, the one that's opposed to, upside down, against, and all that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I don't think you can devote enough time to knocking this down.
I don't think so either. I think it's because religion has been presented as the as God's representative, as the path to God, and it is so obviously untrue and so counterproductive that if you don't declare what Yahweh has told us, that no, he's opposed to religion, he's anti-religion, and religion leads away from him, that don't judge him based upon religion, because he is equally as condemning of religion as any rational person should be. Somebody's got to tell that story. It's there for us to tell. And, you know, it's like Chabaouk. The Chabaouk prophecy begins by saying that this prophecy that I'm writing here is going to speak volume in the end.
Yeah.
He's talking about us.
Yeah.
Well, so what if we were to say, you know, we're just not going to do it because people don't want to hear it?
No thanks. I've used a lot of this. I love it. This is beautiful stuff.
No,
I love
the way
it ends. You talk about leaving no room.
It's just not that. It's not only that God wants us to do it and told us that we were going to do it. You know, I hate fall.
Here's the real reason for the people like Terry and I who really wanted to know, and that's the reason we buy all these books and bought all these books when we were Christians. Trying to read it, we really, really wanted to know, and we did go behind the doors as best we could to figure out whether this is true or not based on, we thought scholars were scholars, and they pursued truth, because that's the way I understood PhD is supposed to be. Well, I know I'm stupid, but, you know, I believe, I took it at face value, mistakenly, but, and then you read these things, and you go, I don't know, you know, and you don't have enough evidence to prove them wrong easily.
Right.
And so the fact that you run across Yad Yah or Introduction to God, and you say, wait a minute, now I've got proof.
Yeah.
Question and Paul, now you've got proof.
Put it there all the time. It's just that very few
I know, he did put it there, but I knew it was hard
to
cover that, man. Sure. They really covered up, and then they give you all this other stuff. And,
yeah.
But then again, that's what they're relying on. You weren't even lazy. They were relying on indoctrination. Whether it's laziness or indoctrination. And so you buy all these books and they're reinforcing the lie, you know, and the indoctrination.
Right.
I have a whole series of Barclay, which are commentaries on the Christian New Testament. And they constantly saying that, you know, Paul was up against Gnosticism and that this book was written to expose and condemn the Gnostics. And
Paul was a Gnostic.
The whole basis of his letters is Gnosticism. You know, how could you miss that?
Yeah.
Because if I said the truth, no one would buy your books because the only people that are buying the books are the religious schmucks.
Yeah, that need.
Well, now see, there's the reality. That's the reality. That's the reality.
Let me ask you two guys something. If they expose Marcion, and Marcion was least faithful to his own point of view, I mean, he wiped out everything that wasn't Paul, and the church called him a heretic when the church should have embraced Marcion, you would think. Why do they carry the Old Testament with them?
Well, the reason that Marcion became a foe of the Roman Catholic Church, originally he was a friend because he was the most prolific publisher of manuscripts, and he was promoting the same Christianity that is Roman Catholicism, but he was doing it openly under his view of Gnosticism. But he became extraordinarily popular, and so he was a threat to the Roman Catholic Church on that point of view.
That's why
the history. But well, no, that's not the primary reason he had to go. I mean, yes, he became more popular than any pope because he had money and he used the money to create influence.
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem, and that created the initial animosity. It's not the reason he had to go. What was the if you owned a copy of even the Christian New Testament,
mm-hmm.
And you were not a part of the Catholic Church, you were not a priest or cardinal or bishop, and you just owned it in any language, what was the consequence?
Yeah,
if you
translated
it in
the common language
service.
Of the people, right, if you wanted to be translated in the common language of the people, you not only were labeled a heretic, they'd go out and torture you.
You were usurping their authority.
Right,
sure.
And then they would try to find every copy and they would burn them. Why? Yep. Because it's impossible to present oneself as the controller.
Orator for God. Yeah.
Right. if people could actually read what God had to
say,
the Roman Catholic Church is only going to appeal to people who are willfully ignorant and willfully irrational.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah, right. No, I mean, that's
and so what did
right.
what did
yeah.
Marcion do? He spent his fortune
everybody see it. Yeah.
Translating and copying the letters that Paul wrote. And so
you're right, and then he'd distribute them out there
that the Roman Catholic Church continued to speak Latin when the people no longer spoke Latin because that way the people were easy to control because they remained ignorant.
Now, to show you how that doesn't die, this week the president of, or premier, or whatever he is, of France, he's trying desperately to have Google in France as well as other places.
Right.
Be totally at their disposal to wipe out anything they don't like. So you can't Google anything without their.
Yeah. There's a new law that was passed in Europe on hate speech. Yeah,
well, you would think that they had a propaganda ministry over there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's the same thing. That's what Hitler did. Russia is what you're doing now in France.
Only say what they want you to say.
Yeah.
Right. Truth is not an alibi.
Anything they don't want you to Google, that's why these shows will be shut up one of these things. I hope everybody's
making trouble. Yeah, in my view, we have less than 10 years.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. To get this stuff out, yeah. I mean, you're the trial balloons within the United States were so effective because they could try one state, and they didn't particularly pick California and New York for many reasons for a lot of years. And now they've found that they can get away with it in Portland, and they can get away with it here, and they can get away with it there. And so they run trial balloons. Now, the globalist idea, and this is what I've seen, what appears to be true to me, is that they'll run a trial balloon in entire countries now and say, well, we got away with it there.
Bernie Sanders is a trial balloon. Bernie Sanders is the appeal of the Toryless one 10 years ago. Right, and it's... You know, all of the young people and the highly educated are saying, oh, he's a man of great integrity. He's the man that we can trust. He's the real deal. And all he's preaching is, let's take
communism.
Whatever the earnings and the savings are of the 1% who've been the most productive, and let's use it to give you free education, give you free medical care, because you're all entitled to medical care. You're all entitled to free education. You're all entitled to an income. And so we're going to forgive all of your debts. Yes, you signed papers that said you'd pay back these loans. We're just going to forgive them. You don't have to pay them back. And so the appeal of a Bernie Sanders, 45% of Americans are Democrats, and half the Democrats love him, and it's particularly the young and the educated. He has the exact appeal of the Toryless one, known as the Antichrist. He's going to be considered as sincere and as credible and believable, and as having great integrity. While he tells people that your promises, your commitments, your obligations mean nothing. You're entitled to take what other people have. You deserve it. That's the appeal.
That's called theft.
Bernie Sanders is the trial balloon for the economics of the New World Order. I've said this for many, many years, and it became obvious to me. The way that the Toryless one, the Antichrist, is going to to appeal to people is he's going to blame all of the world's foibles on the 1% that are the most productive. He says, we're going to take everything that they have, we're going to confiscate it, which is the right thing to do because they stole it from you, and we're going to forgive every loan. So your mortgage is forgiven, your car loan is forgiven, your student loans are forgiven. We're going to forgive every loan. All you have to do to get your loan forgiven is to sign up for, sign a pledge of allegiance to me and to my new system, and we will we'll send you money. We're going to have a new currency. We'll send you money, and all your debts are forgiven. And if you had any savings, if you had any assets, we're just going to confiscate them. So the productive, we're going to neuter, and we're going to make the rest of the world wholly and completely dependent. That is the scheme that's going to be used. Bernie Sanders is articulating that scheme. He is a trial balloon for the Torahless one, the Antichrist.
Well, I mean, they've done it. They've done it before. I mean, you know, any place where they could implement socialism, fascism, communism.
Cyprus banking thing, remember that?
Trial balloon. Cyprus is, I've been thinking about the whole time that Larry's been talking here, where they confiscated the savings of everybody except those people that had less than what it was, a few thousand dollars in the bank. They confiscated the rest of it. You know, that is what they want to do. If you can neuter the people who are productive and you make the rest of the people wholly and completely dependent, you have absolute and complete control.
You know, I'm not having trouble hating like we were talking about earlier. We don't hate enough. I'm starting to really get a hate on there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you think about all the effort and work, and then you've got people involved in just stealing labor, people's labor. It's just unbelievable. I mean, it is surreal, isn't it? I mean, it's surrealistic. I mean, I never
was.
It was about 10 years ago they really, really started coming right out front with theft.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, by the way, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know what his, what is the thing that, besides the 1% of productive people, and by the way, you could steal 100% of the wealth of productive people, and you wouldn't even make
any
rounding error dent in the nation's deficit or ongoing imbalance of payments. But guess what else that Bernie Sanders is overtly opposed to and has the delegates that he has, the Democratic Convention, are overtly hostile to?
Israel.
What?
Israel.
They want to
eliminate Israel and to give the so-called Palestinians a state. Yeah, they are.
Well, that's going to happen.
Israel, right?
Well, it's not really going to happen. They're going to try.
Guess what race Bernie Sanders is? Guess what race?
He's Jewish. I know.
There you go.
I know that. I mean, it's hard to imagine. But, you know, that's the same thing. George Soros type guy.
Yeah,
you know,
that, yeah it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Sure. Wow.
Yep. So, it is absolutely shocking. So we're seeing it manifest right before our eyes. And if you didn't know that God was angry with his people and despised their politics and despised their religion, you would have no basis of really understanding why Bernie Sanders is the model for the Torahless one. And, you know, it's interesting. You look at politics today, and all of the leftists want to present Donald Trump as the big bully, as the person that is inspiring hatred and violence, and they want to present him as the new Adolf Hitler. I mean, that's the way they're all, almost universally, presenting Donald Trump.
And he's pro-Israel.
Yeah, and by the way, and all the violence at Donald Trump rallies.
I wasn't aware of it. I hadn't been watching.
Opponents to him that are, you know, they're carrying Mexican flags and that are carrying communist symbols and are not only antagonizing but attacking the Trump supporters. I disagree. I disagree with almost everything Donald Trump says. I disagree with almost everything he wants to do. And yet, I will tell you that because of those who oppose him, I find it difficult to be opposed to him.
You know,
who oppose him, I despise.
I was talking to Jackie last night, and I don't do politics anymore. I don't do the military anymore for two reasons. These are things that I gave a lot of time to, and I don't want to be affiliated with them at all. And so I wasn't even aware, you know, when it finally came down to Trump getting the nomination or whatever, I wasn't even aware of it, okay? I really wasn't. I wasn't aware who the front runners were. I was not aware of any of it. I stayed completely away from it. And the only reason I knew is because of this show we do, where you had brought it up. But when she was talking to me last night, Jackie seems to think that he's not a part of the cabal because too many people are hating him. Now, that can all be part of the shtick.
I happen to agree. He is not part of the cabal.
So that's why they all, so well, right. You know,
right.
Whether that's you agree with him or not, at least
he's they all hate him. And the media hates him, is that he's not part of it. He stands apart from it. And that's the part that makes him appealing. But unfortunately, what he says about the military is the antithesis of what's right. What he says about immigrants is the antithesis of what's right. What he says about Islam is right, but he says it out of ignorance, not out of intelligence.
Yeah.
And so... if you listen to what he has to say, you know, about torture and about deporting people and the like,
and
building up the military and whooping the Islamic State with more military as opposed to just isolating them, what he says is deeply, deeply troubling. You listen to some of his speeches, he goes into childish rants, and you wonder why in the world is he still down there in the gutter? He doesn't. There's almost no question that he answers. We just say, "Well, that was thoughtful." No, he's giving.
I'm believing you. I have to.
You know, it's
to
like
them.
the anti-Islamic groups in Europe, and IQ would side with them, and I'd say, no, I'm not siding with them because they're not against Islam because Islam is a terrorist manifesto or criminal enterprise or that. The Quran is the worst book ever written, or that Muhammad was a sexual pervert. They're not speaking up against Islam on the basis of reason. They're lashing out at it because their skin color is different. This is mine. You can't have mine. I'm not going to share anything of mine with you. They're lashing out at a very visceral.
Racist
kind of a level, and I don't want to be associated with that. Just because they're opposed to something doesn't mean they're right. I think there's a lot of allegiance to Donald Trump with people who viscerally are opposed to things that I'm not opposed to.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think
you've
got a peg right there.
Well, okay. I've got to ask you guys. I mean, you know, from what I'm hearing, and last night I looked at some YouTubes where, you know, the anti-Trump people were out there in full force, knocking down horses and every other.
Right. Oh yeah, they were disgusting.
Yeah, and they were screaming USA while they carried Mexican flags. I didn't get that at all. Where's the disconnect here?
But the people who despise, my wife and I are in the same boat here. The people who despise him, we are disgusted by the people who are opposed to him. And the people, the relentless onslaught against him in the media and from uppity politicians.
Is what makes him appealing. I get it.
But I can't go to the point of appealing because I'm opposed to most of what he says.
No, I'm not saying, you're certainly not promoting government or voting or getting behind some guy and carrying his mantle. But it sounds to me like he's the guy that's going to win, is what it sounds like. Because I don't see him losing to a Bernie Sanders, or I really don't. I think he's too media savvy. Or to a Hillary Clinton.
I don't see both of them. But imagine what America has fallen to have those two be the. But it's like Obama.
It's astounding. It's astounding.
Obama and McCain, or Obama and who is the Mormon? You just go and say, oh my God.
Romney, the magic underwear guy that went up there to lose, the smiling idiot.
What an hell have we become?
Yeah, I know this. When I was involved, I at least was involved with somebody that gave what appeared to be some thought. Alan Keyes was my guy that I actually worked with in a presidential debate as a
Alan
chair.
Keyes, his rhetoric was sound.
Yes,
but
it was.
The fact, of course, he still wanted to, he was a constitutionalist, patriotic American, and now that we know that he was wholly opposed to government,
I'm no longer involved.
He was amongst the most sound individuals, rationally sound individuals in politics.
Yeah, to sell.
He was the most saleable.
But we were out there fighting for votes for this guy. I'm going to tell you right now, just so people can know how this is done, we were spending $4 a vote, okay?
Yeah.
And Bob Dole, he was out there whipping our ass, and he was spending $2.50 a vote, $250 a vote. I mean, he was bringing them in and giving them Godiva chocolates and everything else. It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Jeb Bush down in Florida running for this president. I mean, he was up there at $150 to $200 a vote. I mean, that's the kind of money that they.
He was just getting started. Trust me.
Working for him. He was spending a lot of money getting no votes.
Yeah, right. I mean, people have had enough of the Bushes. They understood. Well, let's see. Regulation goes up. Taxes go up. He's certainly not going to appeal to Democrats.
Wars go up. They're counterproductive.
Right.
Deficit goes up.
Right.
Yeah,
and all these bad things happen to you under a Bush. Yeah, and Republican voters, and there is a difference between Republican and Democratic voters. Democratic voters are just out of their minds. Republicans are out of their minds in that they have to be diehard military supporters, and they throw their trillions of dollars away that way. And the rest.
Something has changed in America, and this really. Paul falls right into what Yahweh said in Yeshaya 18 when he's talking about the nation projecting its power via its Navy and Air Force. That liberals now are as patriotic and as pro-military as are conservatives.
I have noticed that it was
the conservative, the Republican, that wants a strong defense and didn't want to spend money on social programs. And the Democrat and the liberal that wanted to spend lots more money on social programs than to take it from the military. That's not the case anymore. And I think the reason is that the liberal has come to realize that the ultimate control mechanism is the military.
And it's frightening.
Yeah, so now they're on the same page as it relates to the military. When it comes to exposing and condemning the military, I don't think whatever we have in our company, whatever the number is of people that are part of the covenant, that are willing to do it, that's it in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're a small group. I mean,
I think everybody's going to take the military.
Yeah. I mean, everybody else is pro-military. I went to a museum with my son 2 days ago, second largest Air Force museum in the world. And, the first exhibit was the second plane that Orville and Wilbur built. The first plane, of course, is in the Smithsonian Institute, the Wright Flyer. The second one was for the U.S. military. And it shows the military version of the plane and them training two military officers on how to fly the plane. And within 5 years of that time, airplanes were weaponized. Within 10 years of that time, they were being used in World War I. And they were being equipped with all manners of guns and abilities to drop bombs. And you look at what we, that man's fixation with death. And then you look at the modern weapons. I mean, in this museum, they had a B-2, which is a billion-dollar airplane. We only have 20 of them flyable in America.
They've done basically nothing.
Billion-dollar airplane sitting right there.
Yeah, they do nothing.
Display, right next to a B-1, right next to a B-52.
Mm-hmm.
Right next to, by the way, with the one airplane that if I had airplane lust, this is the airplane that I lust for. I just think it's the one
of
the most magnificent, the SR-71. I think the SR-71 is from a design point of view, that's the Blackbird. It's a spy airplane. But from a design point of view, look up SR-71 or the Blackbird sometime. And,
yeah, I know Lockheed made it. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, from Stunworks. It is such a stunningly beautiful piece of hardware. Anyway, they have one of those sitting right next to it, too. And I understand that its mission was to spy, and I'm opposed to that. But, you know, and in this room, they had Predator drones and Reaper drones and Global Hawk drones and all manner of warplanes and all
drones,
all of these that's our three newest drones.
Yeah, they're stepping right up there.
Right.
Yeah. We don't even need
to
tell a pilot to do it anymore because he might refuse.
I was unaware of this. Have you ever heard of an airplane named the Boxcar?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You know an airplane called the B-29?
Yeah, sure. Bomber.
Okay, what was the B-29 bomber? What was it most famous for?
Forward.
Well, it was...
it was the first long range bomber.
It was the Super Fortress. It was the Flying Fortress. It was World War II.
The Flying Fortress. The B-29
super
was the first really long-range super bomber. It's the one that dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Enola Gay was the B-29 that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Boxcar is the name of the B-29 that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. It's sitting there on display, along with the atomic bomb that it dropped, right there in the Dayton Air Force Museum. And people are celebrating it, yeah. There's a room there that had 8 intercontinental ballistic missiles and actually had displays of the MIRVs, the multiple warheads, the nuclear warheads that sit on top of these missiles. I even talk about it right now, and I go back to being in the middle of that room surrounded by these intercontinental ballistic missiles that carried nuclear bombs, and my skin crawls. That's what man does. You know, why did Iowa create the flood?
Because they were killing everything.
Yeah,
destruction.
Everything. And what do we make? We make killing machines.
Mm-hmm. That's all we do make with the damn too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and along with it, you know, you have a God component. You know, God bless America, the flag.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised they don't have, you know, God bless America on the sides of the intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yeah, they may on some of them. You just don't know. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just crazy. There was a movie years ago. You guys remember Planet of the Apes?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if it was. I think it was part two. Yeah, Charlton Heston. But I think it was part two. It may have been part one, where they get into this place where these religious guys in these robes and they're all worshiping, and it turns out when they worship some atomic bomb, you know. It puts me to mind of that, really.
They call these things.
Our safety is based on that.
Yeah, they call these things the peacekeepers.
Yes.
They call it what?
Peacekeepers.
Peacekeepers.
Maybe it's for good.
There was actually
they call the bomb the boxcar is the airplane that dropped the bomb that ended World War II as events well. Ended World War II.
Yeah.
What did we do? We chose with our last two bombs that we were not going to attack military targets. No, we were going to attack civilians. We were going to bomb two places where there wasn't any military asset, that all the men that were of fighting age had left. We're just going to bomb two places where there's a bunch of women and children, men and women. Yeah, we're going to roast them alive.
That's great. That's so proud of people, aren't we?
Yeah, but it ended World War II, so aren't we grand?
Oh, did it? We ain't start warring with somebody since.
Yeah, we have
been fighting for it.
Within 5 years, the Chinese, and, you know, the huge exhibits there, too, the Flying Tigers and the Burma Road and the flying over the hump and us supporting the Chinese against the Japanese. But we supported Mao Zedong over Chiang Kai-shek and left China.
Oh, that's a fact.
So bad that, you know, that 40 million Chinese starved to death. because of what we did. And, you know, and you...
Now, ask yourself, what was the main job of the Flying Tiger? Do you know?
Supply weapons and to the Chinese could find the fight the Japanese.
They did that, but mostly it was dope dealers.
Oh, yeah, great. So we funded it by narcotics.
So these were the four runners to
the British had the monopoly on the Chinese dope dealing, and they were flying the dope. And when Mao threw everybody out of China, then we carried on in Laos. At a time in Laos, we were having to import for the people so they wouldn't starve rice because we had converted all of the land, good land, to growing dope.
Oh, great.
Truly.
Yeah, there was a whole period where we couldn't go into Laos because we were using, the CIA was using it for the production of drugs that were in the coffins they were sending back with the Americans.
Okay.
Filled them with drugs, which is the reason why the family couldn't see the remains until after the CIA had cleared it, and they were using it to smuggle drugs, and that's how they were funding the CIA and all of its covert wars.
And of course now we have Afghanistan, so we don't need that.
Of course, Afghanistan is absolute and total proof that the America uses its military and CIA to sell drugs, to manufacture and sell drugs.
Well, I just throw that out for anybody who still thinks that we're exceptional and we should be supporting the American military or the American government. It's just, God was true when he said, you know, walk away from this stuff.
We certainly have some exceptional leaders.
Became a cargo company after the war. The Flying Tigers was created by civilian pilots. It was all civilian pilots. It preceded the Army Air Force, so it was all civilian pilots. And they were transport pilots, and they came out of the war as transport pilots, using the same name, Flying Tigers.
Yeah. Sorry, put it down for down.
Well, they would have become Air America. That's what would have happened with that. I mean, Air America was exactly that. You know that, right? I mean, that was the whole. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, America's fixation right now on drugs is so enormous. But you just drive a car and witness how many people are incapable of making the very simple decisions that are associated with driving. And I'm here to tell you that it's not just because they're fixated on their cell phones and text messaging and surfing the internet. No, it's because they're drugged.
Well, they say 1 in 3 now on the road is has partial drug or alcohol
impairment.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, when I witness people's judgment, it's almost to the point now where I don't want to drive. My wife and her last two drives was hit by somebody both times. Somebody incapable of making a rational decision. One guy was on the interstate and driving a gravel truck, decided he didn't like how traffic had slowed. And in so the slow lane of traffic, he decides that since he passed the last exit, he'd just back up. Ran right over the top of my wife's car.
Well, not to feel all alone, that happened to my wife sitting behind a truck at a stoplight. He just all of a sudden started backing up. People are nuts.
Absolutely. To understand what's happened to the West, and particularly now here in America, all you have to do is get in your car and pay attention to what's happening around you and people's absolutely incapacity to observe what's happening around them and make rational decisions in a timely fashion. They're incapacitated. They can't do it. It's why they're so easily duped by patriotism and militarism and this notion that your military deserves your respect. Boy, as I was listening to the radio and television on Memorial Day, I wanted to puke. The number of people that are active service and that have served this country and made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. And you drive by a church and it's surrounded by flags.
Oh, you know what? We went to lunch between shows, Terry and I, and we passed the Orthodox Church up here on First Roosevelt, and there was a sign on it that says, under new management. we took over.
You're kidding.
I'm sorry. Under new ownership.
New ownership. You know what they've been doing with the synagogues throughout Europe? Because there are the Jews are leaving Europe in droves because some of the synagogues in Europe are being converted to the mosques.
Really?
Really?
I'm not
a fan of rabbinical Judaism, but my gosh, that makes me ill.
You know, when you consider the religions of the world, it's a race as to which is the worst and which God hates the most. But, overall, rabbinic Judaism is a lot less destructive and conniving than is Christianity. And Christianity is less violent and menacing than is Islam. I want to make sure that, that we don't leave out Hinduism in their caste system
and
their sexual
system. Right.
Or socialist secular humanism, which has been responsible for a couple of 100 million deaths over the last 100 years.
Well, you just can't leave any of them out. They're all damaging and they're all awful. And that's that. I mean, that's the real fact. And you know, want to know the truth? You know, what kills me? You want to know what kills me from just a rational point of view?
Yeah.
How do you flood, say, London with a bunch of Pakistanis, basically, and turn it into London Stand, where now there's certain areas, if you're drinking a beer, they jump you and beat you up and so forth. Have Sharia laws and courts and everything else, and put all these people on welfare.
Right.
I mean, that's what they do. The Western leaders are doing this. These are the people overseeing this takeover. And it's got to be intentional. You can't stupidly do that.
Right. You know, there was an article the other day that I read that was talking about the number of sex slaves and worker slaves in Europe now is well over 1 million. And that European slavery is over 1 million people. And that the source of the slavery has come from 4 countries: Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya.
Yeah, who brought them in?
Muslims have enslaved people. Now, we're told that only 1 million refugees have settled in Europe. And yet there's 1 million
sex slaves.
Muslim slaves, both sex and they're also agricultural slaves. 1 million of them.
Yeah. So that means that we're really talking about 10 million or something.
How many there are there, but it's a point of no return. And, of course, you have this religion enslaving people.
Well, put yourself in a position of you're one of the Western oligarchs, okay? And you've decided that you're going to take out Syria.
Okay.
So you go do it. And then you flood your own country with these people, and you put them on welfare.
Right.
Now, if you're one of the people in that country, how should you feel about that? About your own leaders?
But they're not thinking. That's what they're counting on.
There you go. They're the ones driving down the road here, a third of them.
Right.
Room
they're not thinking.
That you're
not
talking
thinking.
About.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, they're indoctrinated.
And I do.
Do not think.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there it is. And that's how this really works, isn't it?
Right. And that's the whole reason why we've taken this approach to Yahweh's testimony. Here's what God said. It's for a thinking individual. If you don't want to think, it's not going to appeal to you. If you want to be surrounded by the opinions and the indoctrination of religion and politics and patriotism, this is not going to appeal to you. And until you're willing to leave those things and open your mind and to be rational, to invest the time to learn the facts, God's not going to appeal to you. And you're going to be lost, and you're a zombie. You are the zombie apocalypse is 99% of people alive today.
The
zombie apocalypse is very real. 99% of people are the walking dead. They are lumbering to their death thoughtlessly. But for the 1%, that are open to the truth. And for the one or the million who are going to embrace the truth, we're going to share the truth. and we're not going to make it up. We're not going to share our opinions. We're not going to tout our agenda. We're simply going to say, this is what God said. Take it or leave it. As for us, we're going to take it. Boy, there's some things, fellas, that, I mean, I'm going to tell you, I'm really in love with what I learned in the first two chapters of Yashayah. But I've taken a diversion for an entire chapter in the Chronicles. And, oh, my goodness, are there insights that
really?
Are worth considering? Oh, it's just marvelous stuff.
I can't wait to get my hands on them. Really.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought that Chronicles, which was just, you know, a chronicling of history, mm-hmm. would be so rich in terms of insights into Yahweh's nature. But, you know, just discussions of the Yabusi that wanted to give but ultimately sold the threshing floor. Why was the threshing floor? Where Zion is, where the Temple Mount was, where what was actually constructed there? Why was it constructed there? What did Yahweh have against Dode? What did he love about Dode? It's all there, and it's in spades, and it is so rich. You know, this last passage, I've just started to analyze it, of God saying, you know, Solomon's not ready. He's way too soft. Way too genteel. And you know, here's Dode inspired by God to say, you know, the soft pussyfoot genteel guy, the Christian Jesus, I got no use for. The Yosha of Montanya 23, that guy I've got use for.
Mm-hmm.
But the genteel, all loving, soft, tender, no.
Forgive everybody.
Well, that's the whole politically correct shtick, and that's right. These guys that they march out today with the $800 haircuts, and they're smiling at you, and they're metrosexuals or whatever they are, and they all look the same. Yeah, have you noticed that? The longer they stay up there, the more they all look the same. And these are your world's leaders. I mean, think about that. I mean, really, I look at some of these people and go, this guy's a leader? Really?
Really? Yeah. Yeah, you look at Rubio down there in Florida and consider the affinity that he had with the Republican establishment, and you say, wow, are Hillary Clinton, that's the best they could offer in the Democratic Party. Or Ted Cruz, oh my God, Lion Ted. These are your leaders?
It's pretty wild, and I mean, obviously, there's none of them out there that would actually climb to that level.
Yeah, who were the military and political leaders that decided that what we needed was a B-2 bomber? Once we realized that the B-52 was a complete boondoggle and a waste of time, what we needed was to spend hundreds of billions of dollars researching to build 20 batwing bombers just because we could. Or we're going to build a F-22 stealth fighter to replace the original stealth fighter just because the old one was older, and we wanted to create a new, cooler-looking one, and we make about 50 of those. We decided, you know, what we really need is a F-35 joint strike fighter, and they're going to cost a few hundred million dollars apiece, and we're going to spend another few hundred billion in research, and we'll produce,
you ask who these people are?
Like 30 or 50 of these.
They're people that get paid a commission, pal.
Right. You're talking about airplanes that have no purpose.
No.
Nothing we're ever going to do with them that's going to have any value, and here we are spending hundreds of billions of dollars creating handfuls of these things that we'll never use.
Yeah, but you're talking, as an example, say the B-2 stealth is an example. I think it's flown two missions or so.
There is nothing that you could use it for that would have any value. There's no scenario that you could even describe for it that would ever have any value.
I believe one of them was even shot down in Iraq, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it's just
No, they didn't.
Really
went down. No, we only have 20 of them. And
yeah,
they,
well,
and
I thought they, or maybe he flew one mission. It's you know, kind of fuzzy in my head what I read about. It was a while
ago. Well, we deployed a few of them for over Iraq just so that we could say that we actually used them.
Yeah, well, but
know,
yeah.
Flying an airplane, it cost $1 billion.
Yeah, imagine that.
Over to destroy tents and camels. The more you use it, the more you lose. I mean, that's the whole mindset of Vietnam. We used these what were state of the art at the time, B-52 bombers with their eight engines to drop chemicals on jungle. And so here we're carpet bombing jungle. And so between the expense of the airplane, the expense of the crew, the expense of the fuel, the expense of the bombs, the more we deployed, the more we lost. And all the while, we're burning people alive, and we're manufacturing more enemy than we could possibly have killed.
Let me give you a quick lesson in military World War One. They had figured out that airplanes could only go so high, and they had dirigibles that would carry the airplanes way up higher so you couldn't get to them, so they could drop them down from there. And that's where you get the term naval aviator, because they could land on a little hook.
Uh-huh.
And it was the most efficient thing they had come up with. And then somebody said, you know, we can make a whole lot more money if we put airplanes off of aircraft carriers. And they said, well, that's not near as efficient or safe. But they said, I know, but we make so much more money. So guess what we got?
So the one where more money was made, of course.
Aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with need or want.
Yeah,
I mean, it has
there are more pilots and airplanes in the Navy than there are in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you have Air Force bases, naval Air Force bases, nowhere near water. It's because they're all dirigibles. You know, there's the Naval Air Force.
That was my first job, actually.
Really?
I was a door-to-door dirigible salesman. You know, I mean, you first had to isolate the person. You know, you had to find out if they had a spare warehouse or anything, you know, that they could actually store it in. You'd tell them what you were doing. They said, you mean a blimp? A Zeppelin? Yeah, a dirigible. You know, I didn't do well. I was out there making, you know, negative. I went negative. I ended up not selling one, and I just said, well, you know, this thing's not going to work out for me. So I moved on.
As long as you make your draw.
But how in the world could you be a congressman and approve? You know, we've just approved spending $100 billion more on a new supersonic bomber because America needs a supersonic bomber to replace the B-2.
Well,
they've lost their minds because they're going, yeah, more military. Yeah, that's what we need. That's what we need. Of course, you know, that's not really going to work out because in the end, and this is funny because these are people that advance the idea of God's with America and everything. But yet, Yahweh tells us the word he uses for America is hoy. And it ends up getting shelled, bombed, destroyed somehow because there's not much of America left after, say, 12 years from now.
No.
So why all this money's being thrown into these kinds of things? I mean, I know why. Because there's people making money doing it. I mean, it's part of the old, you know, military-industrial complex.
Those are the three reasons you need to know prophecy that they... Greg was talking about earlier today.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Do you think that Yahweh, when he was talking about the government of King Shaul, was limiting his conversation, or even was directing his conversation, even 1% of it, to the audience in Israel at that time? Or did God already know what they were going to choose?
Oh, he already knew.
So why did God speak of the consequence of government? Prophecy, right?
Mm-hmm.
To tell us today why he is opposed to government, so that you could choose to avoid it. He had those words penned for us, prophecy.
Well, yeah, he even told Shamwell, you know, don't...
For a reason.
You know, he he said, I already know the answer, but I don't want you to stop, you know, because I don't want anybody to have an excuse, you know.
Yeah, well, giving you an example of Paul, should we listen to what Paul has to say and then expose and condemn it? What did Yahweh tell Shaul twice, not Shibi, Shamuel twice, relative to the people's request for a replacing Yahweh with an earthly king and government?
It's not personal to you, it's to me.
Yeah, listen. But he said, listen to what they have to say.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, listen to what
listen
they have
to say. Listen to the people.
Yeah, listen to what they have to say. Yeah. By the way, it's the same word that is translated elsewhere, it says obey. And they don't translate it as obey there, they translate it as listen. But you know, listen to the people. Yeah, if you don't know who the foe is, it's really hard to do. To be able to effectively communicate why God is requesting that we walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted Shamuel to understand why he is opposed to it, why he won't tolerate it in his covenant family. And the best way to know that is to listen to what they have to say. And so that's why we listen. I listen to what the news says, what politicians say. I went to the Air Force Museum. I witnessed their vehicles of death. Otherwise, how do you expose and condemn it?
No, there's nothing wrong with it. I will often, you know, I'll read articles about politicians and everything like that, but I read them just in order to expose them.
Yeah,
it's the same thing about religion. I mean, you know, we read things and study things about religion, and then we put that stuff out there to expose it. I mean, that's, you know, we're not out there advancing politicians. We're exposing them. Because there's not a single major politician that I'm aware of in the world that's flying straight. You know, even if you want to believe Ben Netanyahu was, with a name like Ben, it really, I have to shake my head. But let's say Ben Netanyahu has somehow held on to a small piece of the world stage for 30 years, because he's been at it he's been in the same cadre of political actors on a world stage for years.
Right.
So let's say that he is legit. Well, he's not doing what Yahweh wants. He says he wants a nation based on the Talmud. Well, right away, Ben, I don't have much use for you. And Yisrael shouldn't either. And then further, what else does he do? Well, he goes out in opposition to Yahweh's words, and he makes treaties with countries that, you know, it's the old, enemy of my enemy is my friend thing. That
he may be the best leader in the world today. I wouldn't shake hands with him. I wouldn't trust him.
No, of course.
I don't support him. The difference is that I'm not opposed to him because I can't be opposed to Yisrael. I'm just not capable of it.
No, it's
not in my nature.
Yahweh deals with Israel. You don't.
I'm willing to say that Israel is estranged from God. I'm willing to say that God loves them in spite of who they are. That they have been and continually are despicable, according to God. God's going to reconcile
his
relationship with them. He's coming back to them. He's going to set up his kingdom there. And so it'd be really stupid to pretend like you're pro-Yahweh and pro-God and somehow anti-Israel. You can't be.
And, expose the wrongs going on in Israel.
They've done nothing to harm me. They've done a lot of things to upset God, but they've done nothing to harm me. I'm not going to be opposed to Israel. And so Netanyahu, I think, is the best politician around today. You know, you look at Putin, who for a while there, you know, appeared to be the most sane politician. You know, he's gone off the deep end. His last speech was embracing Islam and saying, that Russia is the most reliable friend for Muslims. And on you go,
Well, then, you know what he's doing? He's following the same path. You know, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but who's that the prince they're always talking about, the one getting married all the time? One of his wives got killed in a car crash. over in England. He came out several years ago saying that the Western world is going to have to learn to become more like Islam. And then, you know, then you've got the half-Islamic, if not fully Islamic, president in the U.S., and then you've got the Pope coming out embracing Islam. But then if we go all the way back to Babylon, we see the two religions form as one, right? The lunar deity and the sun deity. And so that's what I think we're seeing is just a marriage, you know, just they want to make it as close to Babylon as they can. That's what I think.
A little prototype before the big event. Yeah,
you know, clearly the Torahless one is going to have an Islamic father and an Orthodox Christian mother. There's no question about that. He's going to go to a socialist, secularist, humanist, academic institution. So he's going to graduate from Cambridge and Oxford, Yale, or Harvard.
Probably Oxford.
Princeton, probably already has, but has an Islamic father and a Orthodox Christian mother. I don't think there's any question that's going to be the basis that he's going to come into the world. He's going to be, in other words, he's going to be, though he wasn't born in Kenya, he's going to be just like Obama.
Yeah, he'll be very,
a Roman
very
Catholic mother, a Muslim father, and went to school at a politically correct socialist institution. You know, you want to know what he's going to be like, look at Obama. Mm-hmm. He's going to be the model that he's going to uphold, although he's going to be, well, Obama is very socialistic, bending on communist. Bernie Sanders is even more communistic. So it's the message of Bernie Sanders tied into the style and the motivations of the Obaminator.
Wow. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, communism, the whole concept of communism was to enslave, obviously. That was the whole point of it, to see how stupid people would go for it. You know,
because money, after a while, doesn't mean anything. And after a while, the only thing that has merit to people is control. And so, power control is the thing that people seek, because if you are in charge of an entire country, your overall scenario in terms of what you can do is much greater than it is if you just have a lot of money. You know, if you have a lot of money, people can take it away from you. If you're in charge of a country, you are ultimately powerless.
It's a little rougher thing to do. I think one of the things that appeals to them, and this is my take on it, and this is my answer to people who say, well, why are they keep going when they have everything that they want? And I'm talking about this inner circle. It's that, and I don't think they want to answer for what they do. In other words, today they might, you know, some media guy come up and ask them a question, catch them off balance or something like that. And I just don't even think that I think they look at us as so low. They look at, I mean, the masses as so low beneath them. They just don't really want to have to provide answers for anything they do.
There's an arrogance about it. I am an elitist viewpoint, sure.
Yeah, it's just, how dare you even ask me that question, you know, off with your head.
Who the heck are you to ask me?
Yeah. By the way, takes that approach all the time is Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It just despises the media. You know, what right do you have to ask me that question?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, it's fun to watch.
I have paid no attention to these guys.
It is entertaining.
I'm not going
to. It is entertaining. Yeah, it is entertaining. If it wasn't so sad, it'd be purely entertainment. But it is really entertaining.
Well, politics can become too entertaining for me, to be honest with you. So that's why I don't do it. I just don't do it for that reason. But it sounds to me, and this is just from listening to you guys and hearing what you're saying, and last night a conversation with Jackie, it sounds to me like they're going to install Trump. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, but the national election right now is pick 'em. So much is going to happen over the next 6 months. It's very difficult to know which of those two is going to prevail with all the negatives associated with them. But the only thing that I would lean towards Trump is that there are enough Americans now that are so disgusted with the media, so disgusted with Washington, so disgusted with
political correctness.
and the economy and political correctness, they're just so disgusted by it that for so many people to be rubbing their nose in it, like these protesters violent at the Trump rallies, for every time they do that, they're galvanizing support for Trump. Hmm. Every time the media comes out with another, you know, you look at any day where I still get my 12 newspapers, and there's a feature article in every one of them that's anti-Trump. And the more they do that, the more they're galvanizing people.
Oh, that's astounding. Yeah, oh boy, they're just giving it up. And because
yeah, they are.
Had it.
You're right. They're the bastion of truth, and that if they continue to attack them, that they will ultimately expose it, and that he'll crumble under their withering attack. Well, the fact of the matter is that every time they attack him, they're manufacturing more supporters for him.
You know,
so that's the only chance that he has.
Well, you brought up Mr. Sanders, and by the way, I used to, you know, he's been around a long time, sitting down there running his mouth in the well of the house. I've heard 50 of his diatribes.
Yeah, he was one of those that was criticizing Noah back in the day.
Yeah, he's just straight up retarded. This guy. Yeah. I mean, he's just straight up retarded. And but what's worse,
never had a job in his life, never built anything in his life, and he wants to tell everybody that has been
political
successful that they're scumbags, and all the people that aren't successful that you're owed something.
Well, yeah, that's obviously a shtick. But one of the things on social media. Just you'll get these people that they everything's a Hallmark moment when it's about God or Lord as they call them. Oh, I love you, oh Lord. There'll be a picture of somebody on their knees, you know, shaking in fear or whatever. You know, well, you get the same thing in the political realm on social media. And of course, then you get this mixture, which is really funny because really what they're doing is they're saying that, and of course, this is the caricature of Hessus, where, you know, he's bumping into the lamppost and saying, oh, please forgive me, dear lamppost, and I forgive you, dear lamppost. And he's really, really pulling his hair out about is taking care of the poor. And this is what you see, you know, this trying to meld, you know, communism with Hessus. You know, and there's people that actually think that, you know, Yahweh's focus is on taking care of people that are extremely poor, which is he's not really focused very much on that. If you read his words, I mean, not at all. I mean,
they're translated in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is taking care of the widow and the orphan. When you actually look at the verbs that are deployed, it's God saying that you should quarrel with the orphan, because the orphan is not presented as somebody who has lost their parents, but as somebody who is opposed to God.
Yeah, he's estranged himself from the
country. Yeah, it's not to plea on their behalf. The world is to fight them, to quarrel with them, to be in an argument with them. And so you even find that the renderings in English Bibles that would seem to support that are wrong.
You know what? I'd like to have an accurate translation of that if you could just shoot it over to me, because I'll make a note on it. It's one of the things that actually it bothers me that, you know, people, they'll have a bum on the street, okay? Not a working guy being robbed by the elite now, just a bum on a street.
Yeah.
And they'll say, look at the horribleness here.
Yeah.
And then they'll have a picture of the Pope, you know, sitting there crowning gold and jewels and, you know, people waiting on him and so forth. Yeah. And they'll go, what's wrong with this picture? Well, what's wrong with this picture is that you would even delineate a bum on a street as being somebody to be all that worked up about. I mean, I'm a lot more worried about the guy that's out here working his ass off every day and getting robbed by the government.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, then I am the bomb on the street. And I'm sorry, that's
when is he going to stop doing it? Yeah. The answer to that, where shoot that over to you, it's either in chapter 6 or chapter 7 of Observations for Our Time. I've sent you both the latest versions of both, but it's either in 6 or 7, where it comes up twice. And so if you were to open 6 and 7 and Google widow and or orphan, it's going to take you.
Okay, well, I can do that. I can do
that. Yeah, so it's in 6 or 7. and what God's complaint is, that you don't argue against, you don't plead a case in hostile opposition to those who are fatherless, because the fatherless, he's presented himself as the father.
Yeah, well, sure, I understand what those are. I even understand what an orphan is. You know, they're not talking about somebody biologically orphaned.
That's correct. That is correct.
That alone is amazing.
Yeah, I know, but you got an entire
See, when I came to it, I was trying to translate this. The problem was that the verb that was in English Bibles, you know, you don't plead a case on behalf of the orphan. The verb was a verb that is just speaks of arguing against, pleading against, quarreling with, being in opposition to. And so now you can't have God in opposition to somebody who is a child that lost their parents. So then you have to look up the, now that you have the verb translated correctly, you've got to look up the what is the actual meaning and the related words to the word that's translated orphan, in which you find that he wants us to argue against those who have rejected the covenant, who are fatherless.
It must be in 6. I read 7 thoroughly. I hadn't finished with 6 yet last week. I got tied up with this one, but I bet it's in 6.
Yeah, I bet it's in 6.
I can't imagine I'm missing that.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun as we transition into 6 and 7. They're both on Yahoo.
Yeah, but doesn't that openly bother you? I mean, it really bothers me. That's the depiction that you're supposed to be running around. And it's always used. It's always used in conjunction with let's promote helping the poor, which means more welfare money, more money, more production.
Yeah.
Wrong.
And by you're destroying their character. You're destroying their ambition. You're destroying their sense of values. When you give somebody something for nothing, you destroy them.
Oh, well, that was the whole
Great Society
program.
Is it appropriate for people who are homeless, as Richard was for a while? Is it appropriate that we, as a nation, build more homeless shelters? Absolutely. Appropriate. And that make them safer and you know, so that they're decent bathrooms and showers, decent.
But that's not what it is. That's not what it is.
Yes, but don't give people a housing allowance. Is it appropriate that we have food kitchens where the people working in them are those who are unemployed, but that we, so long as people are willing to go in there without drugs and with respect and are willing to clean dishes and prepare food and maintain the facility and treat it with respect, should we provide food to the hungry? Yes, absolutely. Should it be provided in school so that parents...
Yeah, nobody's talking about being a monster here.
Breakfast? No.
But is it appropriate to say, you know what? We've, as a nation, decided you that are working are going to take care of that problem.
Right.
You know,
should we give 75 million Americans a credit card that enables them to buy food?
Absolutely not. I am amazed at that amount of people. I am amazed.
Should we provide extravagant health care for 100 million Americans who aren't paying for it? No. Should we have medical facilities such that if you don't have any money and you break your arm, we do the right thing and we patch up your arm?
Yeah,
But if you're obese and you have diabetes, no, we don't go to spend the taxpayers' money to fix you.
Yeah, here's
if you have
you
if
talked about what would
you
destroy
get cancer,
people.
It's too bad you're going to die.
Well, you were talking about what would destroy people. And this is one of the things that they did during the Great Society program, you know, when Lyndon Johnson actually implemented that program, was they went out, they sent in the neighborhood of, I don't know if you know this or not, but it's kind of interesting, 2,000 different sociologists and social workers and people like this, and they went out and they interviewed the black community from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And Lyndon Johnson, you know, his question was, what would happen to the black community as a whole if they started ADC and food stamps and welfare and all these things? And to the last of them, as my understanding, they said, it'll destroy it. And he said, good, do it.
Yeah, do it.
Sounds like
isn't that lovely?
Right.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
you know, he's Wow, thank you. Thank you. You did a good... And by the way, education standards, economic standards, and everything else would bear out the fact it would destroy the black community and as a whole.
Right.
And did.
Right, it did.
Yeah.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's the whole Great Society programs, which were presented as elevating and affirmative action and elevating the black community, destroyed it.
Right, which is really the design.
Whole
that was really
dependent. No family, no nuclear family.
You're going to be our experiment. Here's your government
right,
cheese.
Right.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
So that it's only extraordinary individuals that make their way out of it. Otherwise, it's the killing fields.
Yeah.
Drug use is ridiculously high. Murder is extremely high.
Yeah.
Dependency is extremely high.
But by the way, the most religious community in America is black. I mean, that's just a fact.
But it's mostly black women, not black men.
Right, but still, it's still the most religious community in the U.S. I can promise you that. I worked on that.
Yeah. Well, it's societal as well. I mean, it's the meeting place. Down south, there was also churches with a meeting place as well as the religious place. Everything is there.
Well, the women got together supporting one another because they didn't have any men to have been at all, been bumps and left.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I go to a restaurant or someplace and I see a African-American family together, and there is a man sitting at the table that's obviously the husband and father, and they've got two kids that are well-behaved, well-dressed, eating, I'll walk over and just congratulate them. I just said, you know, it's you are an example of what I wish existed, you know, more often. It's extraordinary to see your interaction with your family. And it's so rare that almost all the time that I see it, I go up and talk to them and commend them for what they're doing, because it has become so rare.
I think it's hard everywhere now. They've broken up the home in every society now.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I just...
overwhelming majority of women do not want to be... married. Do not want to be married. Yeah, married.
No, they don't. They don't need a man. They just say, we'll have a baby, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much difference today, but I'm just saying that was an actual plan. That was
That evil.
No, so it's like the Syrian War was an actual plan by the CIA.
Just like World War One was an actual plan.
Maybe.
It was an actual plan.
And the evidence is all out there if anybody wants to
know. World War II was an actual plan. You know, and you know, by the time they got done with World War II, they really had conquered the world because they had denominated the dollar as the international trading.
You know, the one thing that was the most astonishing thing for me about World War II is that it never gets reported. Is at the end of World War II, we had used up 95% of the American oil reserves because we gave it to everybody, all our allies, to fight that war.
Yeah.
And when you lose up 95%, they had no choice, and that's why King Faisal or Saud or whoever he was at the time met Roosevelt on an aircraft carrier and signed an agreement with you know, that we will support the dollars and make it basically
the whole petrodollar thing.
Yeah.
They had no choice. They had no oil.
Well, you know, it's kind of you know, one of the very telling things to me, and was that you had the Prince of Wales, you know, while England's being bombed by the Luftwaffe, you know, writing training manuals for the SS.
Yeah, right.
And you're going, man, this cabal, they're all in this together, you know, and you just sit and look at all this, and you go, you know, it's stunning, isn't it? I mean, it's stunning. It really is.
Yeah, but you know, how speaks of the of Tarshish and why he's opposed to Tarshish and the last days and the merchants of Tarshish, and you drill down on the nature of Tarshish and every aspect that made Tarshish, which was the Punic Empire, the Carthaginians, everything that was unique about them depicts America today. And he's pulling together the merchants, the economic interests of the world, the traders of the world, particularly the oil trade of the world, and the militaristic nature of the world's armies and its politics and its religion, and casting them all together as a singular foe. Mm. So, yeah, he's supposed to.
Wasn't the Quran originally written in Syriac Christian?
Well, no. Arabic, written Arabic, did not exist at the time the Quran was revealed to Muhammad made it up. And the first written Qurans were written in a in an alphabet that's called Syriac Christian. However, that is itself is misleading. There are 22 letters, and there's 22 letters in the Arabic alphabet. The 22 letters convey exactly the same sounds as the same 22 letters do in the Hebrew.
Paleo-Hebrew. Okay.
Every important word in Arabic is a Hebrew word, including Quran. The Quran is written in Hebrew. Arabic is Hebrew.
Okay.
The claim that Quran is written in pure Arabic, that was written in Hebrew.
Yeah. Y'all forgive me, I must go.
Okay.
Look forward to next week.
Yep. Good night, guys.
Well, you guys have a good one.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Larry.
Goodbye.
Always a pleasure. It was fun tonight.
Oh, really. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night, my friend.